This is Radio Times. I'm Artie Moss-Cohen. Here's what David Eagleman writes in his new book, Incognito, about the conscious mind. He says, your consciousness is like a tiny stowaway on a transatlantic steamship, taking credit for the journey without acknowledging the massive engineering underfoot. Eagleman is a neuroscientist, and that massive engineering he refers to is the unconscious. New research is revealing that the processes that we are not aware of drive many of our decisions, emotions, and actions. David Eagleman joins us on Radio Times to take us on a tour through our brain and the complex network of neurons that are firing and sometimes fighting with each other as we go about our daily life. David Eagleman directs the Laboratory of Perception and Action, as well as the Initiative on Neuroscience and Law at Baylor College of Medicine. His new book, Incognito, is subtitled The Secret Lives of the Brain, and he joins us from the studios of KUHF in Houston, Texas. And David Eagleman, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks, Marty. Nice to be here.
Did you consciously agree to this interview?
Well, it's hard to know, right? Because your brain is running all sorts of operations under the hood. Your brain is the most complicated thing we've ever found in the universe. It's running just an unbelievably complex number of operations under there. In neuroscience, we're trying to, you know, just scratch the surface of understanding this organ, which essentially is like an alien kind of computational device. It might as well be something that crash-landed here from another planet. And it does all sorts of decision-making and evaluating of possibilities and simulating possible futures, and then it serves up an idea to us. And we're a funny kind of creature because then we take credit for that idea. We say, hey, I just thought of something.
So you may not have consciously agreed to this interview. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah. Well, likely I didn't. I mean, likely everything in my life leading up to this point, plus the genes that I came to the table with and the environment that I interacted with, gave me a particular kind of brain, and yes, it all led up to this moment, so nice to be here.
Well, nice to have you here. You use wonderful language to describe our brain and how it works and how this sort of mix of consciousness and unconsciousness work or don't work together. And in many ways, you describe it like a parliament, and I'm thinking of the British Parliament and the kind of yelling and screaming that seems to go on in their parliament. Is that a helpful way to understand what might be going on in our brain?
Yeah, so I argue for this team of rivals hypothesis, which is that you're not made up of one thing, but instead you're made up of a number of subpopulations in your brain that are all battling it out to control the ship of state. And just like different political parties, the Democrats and Republicans and Libertarians and so on, they all love their country, but they just have different ways of going about it. And that's exactly what happens with these different parts of your brain. This is why people can argue with themselves or cuss at themselves or get mad at themselves or do behaviors that they then look back on and say, gosh, why did I do that? The question is, who's the I? Is there any real meaningful concept of saying there is an I? More likely, the right way to look at it is how Walt Whitman nailed it. And he said, I am large. I contain multitudes.
Well, are we talking about, and I don't want to belabor this too much here, but are we talking about the American Congress where members will say, and, you know, my friend from Texas, the gentleman from Texas, or are we talking more about the British Parliament where they really do yell at each other? You know what I mean?
Well, it depends on the personality of the person. Yeah, some people are more like the Americans, some more like the Brits. Right.
But I'm wondering about our brain. I mean, is our brain sort of, and the gentleman from blah, 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 or are parts of our brain really in conflict with each other?
Well, that's what I meant, the different personality types. I mean, some people are very good at sort of finding ways of negotiating between the parts of their brain. Other people really suffer from it. So, for example, there are several examples I use in the book about battles between short and long-term decision-making, which is one of the clearest battles to see in all of us. So if I put a bowl of Doritos in front of you, part of your brain really wants to eat those, and part of your brain says, don't eat them. It's a carb fest, and I'm not going to eat them. And so you have this battle, and you go back and forth. I know for myself, I always end up losing that battle. And so, but that's, you know, it's a sort of classic example of part of you wanting one thing, part of you wanting to stay fit and healthy, and so you're fighting it out, and the battle tips one way or the other. But some people have battles that are much more insidious than that. For example, people who are, let's say, the CEO of a company and you know, really successful in life in some ways, but they have something like pedophilia that drives them to collect child pornography, something like that, and they know they're not supposed to be doing it, and they can't stop themselves because in this battle of short and long term, the short term keeps winning, and then they end up losing everything. They end up in jail for the next two decades. And you know, it's these sorts of battles that people really have to worry about, and they're more like the British Parliament in that sense.
Well, but that seems like an extreme battle. I mean, a CEO that you know is struggling with his pedophilia impulses. Because I was actually thinking of Anthony Weiner, and when he was exposed for having sent out some of these racy texts, the response was, well, what was he thinking? And it sounds
exactly,
like,
but
no, go
but
ahead.
That's exactly the same sort of situation. I mean, here he's a, you know, he's a famous national politician. This guy knows what's legal and not legal. He knows what's appropriate and so on. But in the moment, his impulse control, his long-term decision-making mechanisms that should have overridden his impulse gratification, the parliament tipped the other way. It's a perfect, it's a perfect example of this sort of thing where people, take marital infidelities. I was on CNN a couple months ago, right when Schwarzenegger and Dominique Strauss-Kahn, when those news stories broke, and everybody said the same thing, which is, what were they thinking? Well, it's actually not even that surprising, right? People are quite complex inside. We have, of course, millions of years of evolution driving us towards reproductive pushes. And so it's just not that surprising that long-term parts of people's brain can make a marital contract, and short-term impulses can drive them to do something really wrong. Now, this is in no way, by the way, a justification of this sort of infidelity, but it is to say it's not really that surprising.
But are you saying that when we think kind of long-term and perhaps even say, you know, this is the person I'm going to marry or spend the rest of my life with, that that's a kind of conscious decision that we make, and then those short-term decisions or reactions are based on things that we're not aware of, that's the unconscious mind at work?
Yeah, it can often come down to that. It turns out that even some of the long-term decision-making happens unconsciously. But in general, the way we think about the conscious mind is it's sort of like the long-term vision planner for the company. It's like the CEO of a company that says, okay, look, I don't really understand all the operations going on in this massive company of 60,000 people, but I can sort of set the goal for where this company wants to go over the next 5 years. And when I set that goal, I will assume that all the machinery of the company beneath me will adjust itself to match that goal, even if I don't know what's going on in every cubicle and in the mail rooms and so on. And that's sort of what consciousness is like, the long-term goal setter.
Well, you write about Freud, and frankly, I was thinking about Freud, and of course, this is before MRIs and all that, and he seemed to understand the power of the unconscious, the impulses, the experiences that impact the conscious, and of course, part of analysis is trying to make the unconscious conscious so that people can be responsible for their decisions. Are you playing off of that as well, although bringing it kind of a scientific twist?
Actually, no. So Freud was the first guy to really nail this idea of the unconscious. It had been sort of bubbling around in the scientific literature for a few hundred years, but really in a small way, and nobody was paying attention to it. And Freud was the guy who opened the box on this, and he was really correct that much of what we say and do and believe and so on comes from these subterranean caverns that we don't necessarily have access to. I think where modern neuroscience has departed from Freud is in this idea that we can access the unconscious. At least I can tell you my own view, which is that the unconscious runs on its own programming language that wouldn't even make sense to us. It's not like we can speak to it in English and, you know, understand what it's saying or something. What's happening down there is in the brain, you have hundreds of millions of specialized cells called neurons, the cells of the brain, and they're communicating with each other with each one of them is popping off signals up to hundreds of times a second, and you've got hundreds of millions of these, and each one of these is connected to each other in such a staggering sort of complexity that it bankrupts the English language. And that's what's actually happening under the hood, and we would have no way to communicate with it in a meaningful way. So I think the difference from the Freud is that we can sort of understand our motivations. Sometimes we can't. Sometimes we can, but not always, I think.
Well, and that has nothing to do with toilet training, right?
The interesting thing about something like toilet training is one of the main things that the brain is doing is it's constantly reconfiguring its own circuitry. That's what we mean by learning and memory. So when you want to do something, let's say you're a toddler and your mother's trying to teach you how to use the toilet, you're automatizing these behaviors. And so most of what the brain does is it automatizes things, which means it burns it down into the circuitry of the brain such that it becomes automatic and unconscious. Maybe a better example is when you're learning how to ride a bicycle, you have to really do a lot of conscious concentration to figure out what you're doing and how to wobble and move your body. But after a while, once it gets burned into the circuitry, you no longer have conscious access. If someone asks you how you ride a bicycle, you can't answer it anymore.
Well, I'm also thinking of that experience of driving a car. You get into your car, you take the route that you've always taken home, you drive into your driveway, and you say to yourself, how did I get here? That you have no actually conscious memory of making all the decisions that had to go into getting home in a car.
Well, that's right. That's a good example. And in fact, that's where the brain wants to be, is having everything sort of automated. So if the brain is doing its job correctly, it's predicting the future well, it's learning the rules of the world and how to react to them. And in the absolute ideal scenario, it wouldn't have to burn much energy at all, because remember, we're mobile creatures that run on batteries. We don't get to plug ourselves into a wall. And so the main constraint for the brain is saving energy. And the way it does that is by saying, okay, if I learn all the rules of the world and predict everything correctly, then I've got it. I don't need to pay attention. I don't need to figure out new things. The conscious CEO of the company gets to go to sleep at the desk, and the company runs itself just fine. And it's only when things violate our expectations that the conscious mind has to come online and wake up and figure out what the heck to do.
Well, and we're almost having a break here, but it sounds like it's often described that these two parts of our brain are, in a sense, or ourselves, I guess, at war with each other. But it sounds from your description that they largely work well together.
Well, it depends. It turns out that the conscious mind is usually best left out of lots of operations that are well automatized in the brain. So if you really start thinking about how you're playing the piano, you're dead. Or if you start thinking too much about how you're writing your signature, you're going to screw it up. And so maybe after the break, I can expand on that a little bit about different things that you're different ways that your conscious mind is best left out of the picture.
Fair enough. David Eagleman is our guest today on Radio Times. He's a neuroscientist. He's written several books, and the new one is called Incognito, The Secret Lives of the Brain. We're going to take a very short break, get back to our conversation. Also, open up the lines at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Give us a call. We'll be right back.
The Philadelphia Folk Festival proudly supports WHYY. This year's 50th birthday festival brings Levon Helm, David Bromberg, Arlo Guthrie, Tom Rush, Tempest, and more to the Old Pool Farm in Upper Salford for the weekend of August 19th through the 21st for concerts, crafts, camping, and children's activities. The Philadelphia Folk Festival's 50th birthday celebration. Details at 1-800-556-FOLK or folkfest.org.
The right time is almost here for the successful sowing of cool season grass seed. I'm Mike McGrath, and on the next You Bet Your Garden, we'll walk you through a perfect plan for your new lawn, plus organic answers to all your growing questions. That's You Bet Your Garden, Saturday morning at 11, right here on WHYY-FM.
Peter Parker is dead, but Brooklyn's Miles Morales is stepping up to take the web of the iconic Spider-Man.
More recently, when we were sculpting the story that became The Death of Spider-Man, we realized we had our opportunity to redefine Spider-Man for the 21st century.
Marvel Comics Editor-in-Chief Axel Alonso on the new biracial Spider-Man. Next time on Tell Me More. Can you swing
from a thread? This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane talking with writer and neuroscientist David Eagleman, and he says in his new book that some interesting new research is showing that the unconscious plays a much bigger role in our lives than we think, controlling a wide range of our emotions, our behavior, perceptions, and impulses. The book is called Incognito, The Secret Lives of the Brain, and we have calls coming in at 1-888-477-9499. There's so many parts of your book, David, I'm not sure where to go back to, but one of the things you say, and perhaps this helps kind of understand what might be going on, about why it's difficult to keep a secret.
Well, that has to do with this issue of these rivalries in the brain. A secret is just a simple way of seeing that sometimes there are parts of your brain that want to tell something and other parts of your brain that do not want to tell because of fear of whatever the social fallout from that's going to be. And that's what a secret is. I mean, just some years ago, I started wondering, how do we understand a secret neurobiologically? I mean, you know, could a toaster keep a secret? How do you build a neural network that keeps a secret? And I realized it's just a simple example that you need this team of rivals framework to understand it. Because if both, let's say you have two parts of your brain that want to tell the story, that's just a good story. And if two parts of the brain don't want to tell it, then that's just something you keep to yourself. But it's when you have that tension of wanting to expose something.
Toasters can keep a secret better than we can.
And it turns out that keeping a secret is quite bad for you. So one of my colleagues up in Austin, James Pennebaker, has done research and found out that he found out quite accidentally, actually, that when people are holding a secret, they have higher levels of stress hormones, their doctor's visits go up, they're generally unhealthier. And when they let that secret out, even by journaling it, their stress hormone levels go down and so on. So it turns out that having these tensions between different parts of your brain where, you know, part of you wants to do one thing and part of you another thing is, you know, it takes a lot of energy.
Well, and going back to some of the other examples that you include in your book is that we tend to marry somebody or, I guess, end up with someone whose first name starts with the same letter as our first name. Do I have that?
Yeah,
right?
So this is a small but significant result that researchers have discovered. If you go into marriage registries in any county and you look at who's marrying whom, you find that there's a slight statistical likelihood for people, they're more often to marry, you know, Joel and Jenny, Alex and Amy, Donnie, Daisy, things like this. People with the same first letter of their first name. And this is what psychologists call implicit egotism, which is to say we sort of like things that sound like us, sound like ourselves. It turns out we like people better who share our birthday. It turns out that people named Dennis or Denise are more likely to become dentists. And you can verify this by going through dentist professional registries and so on. Now, these are small effects, right? But they're statistically significant. And what's surprising about them is that they're unconscious influences. So if you were to ask these people, well, how did you choose your life mate or your profession? You know, obviously, those are terrible reasons to choose it based on the letters in your name. And it probably wouldn't be part of their conscious narrative, but instead is an influence that they don't have access to. As another example that applies to all of us, if you are holding a warm cup of coffee and I ask you to describe your relationship with your mother, you will describe it as being closer if you're holding the warm cup of coffee than if you're holding a cup of iced coffee.
And because our sort of neural pathways are being influenced by this warm cup of coffee?
Exactly, by the warm feelings it gives you and this. Yeah, exactly. So it's an unconscious influence, though. You know, one example that I put in the book that I was very influenced by myself as a researcher when I saw it many years ago was there was a study where men were asked to rate the attractiveness of women in 8x10 photographs. So it was just photos of their faces, the women's faces. And the men went through and ranked from 1 to 10 how attractive they thought each woman was. And in one set of the photos, the women's eyes were dilated. And the men were uniformly more attracted to these women with the dilated eyes. But the really surprising part was that none of the men noticed that their pupils were slightly wider over here, and presumably none of them knew that dilated eyes is a sign of sexual readiness in women. But their brains knew. Their brains picked up on that, and they were driven to those photographs and found them much more attractive without having any idea why. And the reason I found that so interesting is because, you know, that's the way love always goes, right? You're attracted to some people more than others, and you don't know why. But your biology is running deep evolutionary programs underneath the hood, picking up on this sort of information.
Well, even and adding to that, and I also found this interesting, was that ovulating strippers, and now this gets into some pretty interesting research, ovulating strippers were considered more attractive, right? Because of fertility?
Yeah. So there are all sorts of signals that are broadcast by women and picked up by men about levels of fertility, and all of this runs under the radar of conscious awareness. So just, you know, the general story is that the things that are found attractive in women are all signs of fertility. And the same goes for men, by the way. You know, as children, little girls and little boys look essentially alike. And it's at puberty, right when they become fertile, that things change. Men get bigger jaws and they get stubble broader chest and so on. And the and women get a hip to waist ratio that distinguishes them from little girls. And these are things that are signs of fertility. And it turns out that if you look across cultures, the things that are found attractive are exactly the same hip-to-waist ratio, even though in some cultures slightly larger women or slightly thinner women are preferred, the hip-to-waist ratio remains the same. And in fact, one person did a study looking across the centerfolds of Playboy magazine over the decades, and even as the total body weight has changed, the hip-to-waist ratio stays the same. The point is, it's a signal that broadcasts fertility. And so some of my colleagues in New Mexico did a study where they tracked the amount of tips that strippers received at different times of the month, and they correlated that with their fertility levels. And they found that at peak fertility, they were getting a lot more tips, and at the lowest level of fertility, that's when they were getting the lowest.
Well, and that, of course, is the free will question. I know you've been asked this a lot, because when you talk about this, you know, the unconscious mind in control of so much what we do, that does raise questions about whether we have free will or whether we know that we have it and whether we use it at all. Where do you stand on that issue?
Well, it turns out that there's no killer experiment in the end that shows us at this point whether we have free will or we don't. A lot of neuroscientists land on the side that we probably don't have free will, because you've got this massive machinery of the brain, and every part of the brain is driving other parts of the brain and driven by other parts of the brain. And because it's essentially a vast mechanical network, it's difficult to see where you can slip in the ghost in the machine of free will. And what we know for sure is that you are absolutely dependent on the integrity of this tissue in your skull, because when that changes, you change. If there's a little bit of brain damage, that can change your personality entirely. It can change your ability to see colors or assess risk or simulate futures, things like that. So we know that somehow you are tied to this machinery, and there doesn't seem to be anything else driving this machinery besides itself. And that's why most neuroscientists like to think you don't have free will. I'm not so sure. It may be that our science in 2011 is just too young for us to understand how that works. But what has become clear to me, and what I write about in the book, is that if we have free will, it's actually a much smaller player in the game than anyone previously thought. And the reason is, your brain comes about as a very complex tangle of genes and environment, and essentially what you come to the table with, and every one of your experiences combines to build your brain. And what that means is that brains are very different from one another. Brains are more like fingerprints, in the sense that they're different in everyone. And what that means is that your brain and Jeffrey Dahmer's brain are really, really different. And he can't say, I'm going to use my free will to be just like Marty. And you can't say, I'm going to use my free will to be just like Jeffrey Dahmer. Because your brains have developed on completely different trajectories. And so it's an interesting thing, because when people look at someone else and say, well, I can't believe he did that, you know, the fact is, it's sort of impossible to put yourself in somebody else's shoes neurally. Because if you didn't have in utero cocaine poisoning and lead paint on your walls and this whole particular set of childhood experiences that this person had, you're just not like them on the inside. There's as much variation on the inside as there is on the outside with the way people's faces look.
Well, let me quickly reintroduce you, and I know we do want to get some callers in on the conversation. I want to pick up on what you just said. David Eagleman is our guest. He's a neuroscientist. In fact, he directs the Laboratory of Perception and Action and the Initiative on Neuroscience and Law at Baylor College of Medicine. In fact, joining us from Houston, from the studios of KUHF, he's written several books, and the newest one is called Incognito, The Secret Lives of the Brain. And we do have some open lines at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. And I know, David, that the part of your book is a look at our justice system, our legal system, and figuring out how we can use some of this new science and this neuroscience about our brains and figure out how to make, I guess, a justice system that more responds to what people actually decide to do, what their actions really are about?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, it turns out that our legal system is predicated on our intuitions about why people behave the way they do and what we should do about it. And, you know, we have this very deep retributive impulse built into the system where we want to punish people for breaking the rules. And I get that retributive impulse. Mm-hmm. I feel that strongly. But it turns out that the more neuroscience marches forward and we realize that people's brains come about because of this complicated individual trajectory of their genes and their experience, the more this calls into question this whole notion of blameworthiness. And the argument I make in the book is that actually blameworthiness is the wrong question for us to be asking at all. It doesn't matter how that brain got there and whether we should blame it for being that way or not. Can you blame someone for being schizophrenic, for example? Mm-hmm. Instead, all the legal system has to worry about is what to do from here. In other words, what we need is a forward-looking legal system that says, okay, given the brain standing in front of the bench, there's no way we're going to be able to disentangle how it got here environmentally and genetically. All we need to know is what's the future dangerousness and how can we modulate sentencing based on that? Some people are very dangerous and we have to put them away for a long time. Some people less so, and we can put them away for less time or have other strategies for them. And more importantly, we can introduce new methods for rehabilitation because we understand a lot about the brain now that we didn't understand 100 years ago or even 10 years ago. And there are ways that we can do things more fruitful than incarcerating everyone. As our listeners probably know, America leads the world in the percentage of our population behind bars. We have more of our population behind bars than anybody in the world. It's crazy. It's not particularly humane, and it's not particularly cost-effective. And so what we should be doing is leveraging the knowledge we have about why people behave the way they do and what situations we can help people. For example, if they have a brain tumor, if they have mental illness. You know, 30% of our prison population has mental illness. That doesn't make sense. It's become our de facto mental health care system. It's, as I said, it's not humane. It's also not cost effective. There's so many better things we could be doing to accomplish the ends that we need to.
Well, and I understand what you're saying, and I'm certainly not here to defend our justice system or our legal system, but it does have, even as part of sentencing, I mean, we, for instance, people that are considered to be mentally ill, we don't hold them to the same standard of responsibility for their behavior as someone who's not diagnosed as mentally ill. So as imperfect as our legal system is, and we have various degrees of, you know, criminality or, you know, there's first degree murder, second degree murder, third degree murder. It's a probably imperfect attempt to try to understand a little bit about human variation.
You're exactly right about that. So the legal system has embedded into it some very crude ways of distinguishing brains because the system is strained under this idea that all brains are created equal. It has to admit finally that there are some differences. So, for example, there's a line between if you're under 18 or over 18, you're treated differently because of this realization that kids' brains are just not the same as adult brains.
Right.
If your IQ is less than 70, you're treated as different than if your IQ is over 70. Other than that, however, it's generally the case that all brains are created equal. If you're over 18 and have an IQ over 70, you're treated the same as everyone else. Now, that's with the exception of the insanity plea, which is actually quite rarely used and won. But that's for people who are psychotic and deeply disconnected from reality. So we do treat those people differently as well. So you're exactly right in the intuition that the legal system tries to account for this a little bit. But almost everybody else, sort of 98% of the rest of trials, are assumed that everyone has the same capacity for decision-making, the same ability to simulate possible futures and evaluate them, the same understanding of consequences and so on. And it's a very charitable idea to treat everybody equally brain-wise, but it's simply not true. Along any axis that we measure brains, we find there's a lot of variation.
Well, I just sat on a jury in a criminal trial, actually. And it was a fascinating process in many different ways. But how do you put a brain on trial? I mean, in terms of, you know, justice and getting what victims are due, how do you literally put a brain on trial, or can we? Or should we?
We can, and it's the most humane and cost effective and fairest way for us to do it. In the following sense, let me use sex offenders as an example. So, several research groups for about 20 years now have been following sex offenders who are released from prison. They've been following them out for up to 10 years to see who reoffends and who does not, and then they correlate that with what do we know about this guy? Did he have a bad childhood? Does he have prior offenses? What was his victim choice? What was the age of the victim? Was it someone inside the family or outside the family? Did he have remorse, denial, regret? What was his relationship with his mother? Everything you could possibly measure, right? So they measure all these factors. They see who reoffends and who doesn't. And you find that some of these factors have strong statistical power in terms of their predictive capacity, and some don't. And what you do is you end up building a formula where you say, okay, these are the factors that seem to do the best prediction about who's going to end up reoffending. Now, you can, of course, never really know who's going to reoffend and who's not, because crime is too complicated and life is too complicated and circumstantial. But you can distinguish who's really dangerous, who's really a bad seed, from people at the other end of the spectrum who are not so dangerous. And you can predicate sentencing based on that. Now, this has to be compared to the predictive capacity of psychiatrists and parole boards. When they are asked, okay, for this particular sex offender, do you think he's likely to reoffend or not? It turns out you might as well be throwing darts at a dartboard. They have no statistical correlation in terms of their ability to predict. Humans are terrible at predicting these things, and it turns out there's a lot more power in the numbers, in the statistics, than you might imagine. So it turns out that these actuarial tests are now being used in pre-sentencing decisions for sex offenders. You look at somebody's record, you look at these actuarial tables, and you say, you know what, this guy's pretty dangerous. We're going to have to put him away for longer. You look at someone else and you say, given all these circumstances, this guy's not really as dangerous. We can probably do a lighter sentence here. And that's the sense in which things can be measured and sentencing can be modulated accordingly. Now, sometimes people will say, well, where's the humanity in that if you're using numbers? And of course, the answer is, compared to what? Compared to the way we sentence now? The way we sentence now, ugly people get much longer sentences than pretty people, for example. And of course, minorities get much longer sentences than majority. So, racially speaking, minorities. It's not as though we have some sort of humane good system now. This is something that would actually improve it and, on average, make smarter sentencing decisions.
Well, let's take another short break. We'll get back to our conversation. We do want to get some callers in on the conversation as well. And again, David Eagleman is our guest. He directs a laboratory of perception and action and the Initiative on Neuroscience and Law. That's at Baylor College of Medicine in Texas. He's the author of a new book called Incognito, The Secret Lives of the Brain. You've had a chance to hear a bit of what we've been talking about. What do you think? Give us a call. 1-888-477-9. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
The Wistar Institute is proud to support WHYY-FM. I'm Dr. Russell Kaufman, president of the Wistar Institute, a world leader in biomedical research right here in Philadelphia. Today at Wistar, scientists can explore our entire set of genes to answer the question, what causes cancer? This research guides us to design individual therapies for different types of cancer. The Wistar Institute, today's discoveries, tomorrow's cures, online at wistar.org.
World War I was so bloody, 21,000 British soldiers were killed or fatally wounded in just one day. On the next Fresh Air, Adam Hochschild, author of To End All Wars, talks about the war and the people who opposed it, including men who refused the draft and soldiers who refused to fight, risking prison or execution. Join us.
this afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now. A judge in Ohio rules that an Army vet can sue former Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld. The vet says he was imprisoned and tortured for whistleblowing. Also, a wordsmith says we need more superlatives. Awesome. That's Public Radio's Daily Digest of News and Culture here and now.
Today at noon on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane, talking about some heady stuff, dare I say, with our guest David Eagleman. He's a neuroscientist, author of a new book called Incognito, The Secret Lives of the Brain. We are talking about the conscious, the unconscious mind, and also some new research and what it may reveal about the gray matter in our heads and its various implications for the justice system. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. And David, I'm sure you've been asked this before. I know you've been interviewed a lot on this book. And when you talk about free will and people's brains and their various actions, it does raise questions about, you know, responsibility, whether we are responsible for our own actions, even if there are things going on that we might not be aware of or be in control of.
Well, as I said, it may be that we have some little bit of free will, but it's clear that it's really just a bit player in what's going on. And what I think that means for us is that the whole notion of responsibility is a complicated one. Maybe it's not the right question for us to ask. One of the examples I use in the book is, just as a way of getting into the heart of the problem, is this example of Charles Whitman, who some listeners will remember in 1966 climbed to the top of the tower at University of Texas Austin campus and started shooting people. And he killed dozens of people before he was finally killed. And so what happened is the police force found at his home that he'd also killed his wife and his mother the night before. And he'd left a suicide note saying, "Something inside me has been changing over the last year. And when this is all over, I want an autopsy to be performed." And so that's exactly what happened. They performed an autopsy and they found that he had a brain tumor that had been growing in his head, and it had impinged on a part of his brain called the amygdala, which is involved in fear and aggression. Now, you know, it's impossible to know whether that was the reason for it, but it certainly seems likely. There was nothing about him that had presaged that kind of behavior. Otherwise, he had a very high IQ. He had been an Eagle Scout. He'd been in the Marines. He was working as a student and a bank teller. So when you look at things like that and you think, my gosh, well, what does that mean? Obviously, he didn't choose to have a brain tumor, and anybody else could have the bad luck of having a brain tumor. Well, it turns out we see these kinds of cases all the time. Another example I use in the book is this man who became a pedophile, and his wife had him arrested because he made a move on their prepubescent stepdaughter. And the night before sentencing, he was having these terrible headaches and went for a scan and found out he had a massive frontal tumor. When the tumor was removed, his sexual appetite returned completely to normal. About 6 months later, he became a pedophile again. He started showing signs of pedophilia again. His wife took him back to the hospital. Turns out the surgeons had missed a piece of the tumor and it was regrowing, and they removed it again, and now his sexual appetite returned to normal again. And so what these examples illustrate is this whole notion of responsibility is quite complicated. I mean, you don't choose to have a tumor, and you are tied irrevocably to this 3 pounds of tissue in your skull. And so I think, as I said, for the legal system, probably responsibility isn't the right question. Instead, it's just, what do we do from here?
But can we extrapolate from those two examples? I mean, one, a mass murderer, another, as you describe, a sudden pedophile. Can we go from that to say that everybody that, you know, is a pedophile or is a murderer has something wrong with their brain?
Well, almost certainly we can, but it's not the case that it's going to be something that's obvious. So the way our technology stands right now, we have very fancy neuroimaging technology, but it's still quite crude. If you took most people in a prison population and ran them through my scanners, you wouldn't be able to see something obvious like a tumor. But it doesn't mean there's not something wrong. So if you take a school shooter, Klebold and Harris or Cho, you take these school shooters, whether or not we can identify something in our crude technology, there's obviously something different about their brain. The problem is that neural pathologies can be, you know, deeply embedded into the circuitry of the brain in ways that in 2011 we can't measure, but in, you know, 2200 we will be able to measure. It doesn't make sense for us to predicate a legal system on whether we can measure it right now or not. In other words, we shouldn't say, oh, well, there's clearly something wrong with Whitman's brain because we can measure the tumor, but I guess there's nothing wrong with Klebold and Harris's brain. So sometimes we have to make the assumption that if somebody does behavior that is so statistically abnormal, like a school shooter, that we can pretty safely assume there's something pathologic going on in their brain, whether or not we can measure it at the moment.
Well, let me get some callers in the conversation. Just looks like one open line at 1-888-477-9499. We've been covering a fair amount of territory in this hour as we've been talking about the brain and the conscious and the unconscious. Let me get to Anne from Wilmington, Delaware to join us. And Anne, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi there. I've been a professional hypnotist for 13 years. So as a hypnotist, I work in the realm of the subconscious, which isn't something that I've heard you reference. I'm kind of curious how it fits into your model, because in my line of work, people come to me to make changes, and using hypnosis, they are able to speed up that learning curve, to speed up the rate of change in their lives by making more direct alterations to processes that they aren't typically consciously aware of. And so as I've been listening, I've been trying to put what you're saying into the context of the work that I do as I'm here between my clients today. So how does that fit? How does a tool like hypnosis and the idea of the subconscious fit into the brain?
It's a good question, Anne. David Eagleman, go ahead.
Thanks for that question. I have to tell you, hypnosis sort of stands at the fringe of neuroscience right now, which is to say there's not a lot of study about it. And, of course, it's always been a little sullied by extraordinary claims that ended up not being backed up. So there might be something to hypnosis. I actually think there might be, because I've seen people get into sort of suggestible states that almost appear to be somewhere in between wake and sleep. So there might be something there, but I can only tell you it's not well understood what's happening there with hypnosis. Thanks also for the question that's a clarification. The subconscious and the unconscious are used synonymously in modern neuroscience. There's no real difference between them. I think a lot of neuroscientists gravitate towards using the word unconscious brain just to sort of distinguish it from older Freudian concepts.
Anne, thanks for calling into Radio Times. And I'm thinking of your work and your look at the criminal justice system. I'm wondering whether also understanding the brain helps us understand addiction and the kind of behaviors that people engage in when they are addicted to something, whether alcohol or drugs.
Yeah, so it turns out that the war on drugs, as we've been fighting it, is completely unwinnable. Everybody knows that. And that's because, we're fighting the drug supply. And that's like a water balloon. If you press it down in one place, it'll pop up somewhere else. What you need to be doing with the war on drugs is addressing the demand, which is to say the addict's brain. And at this point, we know a lot about the circuitry and pharmacology of addiction in the brain. And so with some of my colleagues, we're working on this method to try to help people overcome addiction by strengthening their long-term decision-making mechanisms in their brain. So most addicts will tell you, look, I don't want to be addicted, but when it's there, I can't help but do it. And so we're using a technique called real-time feedback in neuroimaging, where we put you in the brain scanner, and we allow you to essentially see the activity in these craving networks in your brain. And your job is to make the activity in those networks go down. And by practicing that over and over, you may or may not even have any conscious access to what you're doing, but you are learning how to strengthen up your long-term over your short-term decision-making mechanism.
And I was thinking of Clockwork Orange, actually, as you were describing that. So it's literally someone looking at, let's say, a glass of whiskey or something like that, and then using their brain to not want it?
Sort of. I mean, it's very important to distinguish this sort of thing from caricaturizations like Clockwork Orange. I mean, it's a totally different ballgame. This is equivalent to biofeedback from the 70s, you remember, where you try to control physiologic signals, except this is now sort of on steroids, because with imaging, you can look inside at particular networks in the brain and represent the activity in those networks by, let's say, a bar on the screen. And your job is to figure out how in this neural parliament to have one party control another party. In other words, we're not changing anything about the person except for allowing them to strengthen their long-term decision-making. They may still choose to go ahead and smoke that cigarette or use the crack cocaine, but they have more choice. In some sense, it's almost as though they have more free will in the sense that they're not completely controlled by their impulse, but at least they have a chance to debate it out.
That's fascinating. Let me get, looks like Anthony from Lafayette Hill to join us on Radio Times. Anthony, go ahead. You're on the air.
I'm interested in the way dreams give us a window into the subconscious, and I, in my personal experience, have incredibly complex and three-dimensional dreams. It's almost like going to a movie that I've never seen, and I often, when I remember them, think about them in retrospect and try to understand the messages, perhaps one might say, that are contained therein.
Well, Anthony, let me see what David Eagleman has to say. Have you looked at actual dreaming, David?
Yeah, I mean, dreaming's so fascinating. We spend a third of our lives in this weird doppelganger state of sleep, and it's not really well understood what that's about and what dreams are about. Sleep in general seems to be about consolidating learning and memory, but the dream content is something that's still hotly debated. In fact, dreams are one of the things that got me also really interested in the unconscious mind because, you know, as Anthony said, sometimes you have situations that you feel you would have never thought of, or sometimes I would hear a snatch of dialogue or even a joke, and I'd wake up and I'd think, that is so interesting or so funny, and who thought of it? I mean, it was my brain, right? But it didn't feel like the conscious me would have ever come up with something like that. So somehow there's this other stuff going on down there. In the book, I quote Carl Jung, who says, in each of us there is another whom we do not know. And I also quote Pink Floyd, who says, there's someone in my head, but it's not me. And dreams is one of the things that got me interested in that concept. The short answer to Anthony's question, though, is that we don't really know if dream content has meaning or not. I mean, a lot of people, of course, take on the interpretation that dream content is telling us a message or has some sort of symbolic meaning. It's not totally clear whether that's true or not. It's an area of active research.
I know that you probably heard this as well, which is that we only use a certain small portion of our brain. Is that true?
It's actually not true. Sort of the opposite is true, which is that your brain is always screaming along with activity under the hood. In any way that we measure brains, we find that that is just pumping along on all cylinders. And it's only your conscious mind that may or may not have much access to what's going on. I think the reason that myth stuck around for so long about only using a fraction of our brain is because it has this implied hope that you might, you know, do something to get sort of, you know, lots smarter. But the truth is that your brain is always moving. It's just that you may or may not have access to what's going on there.
You write about something called dethronement, and this takes us back to when, I guess it was Galileo, right? It was famous. My ignorance is on display there. That figured out that the Earth was not the center of the universe, and that was, you know, a great come down for human beings. But it sounds like there's a certain kind of dethronement going on with, from your perspective, from our conscious and our unconscious mind. Yes?
That's right. So Galileo nailed the evidence that the Earth was not at the center, and then a lot of dethronements happened. Shortly after that, there was a Scottish farmer who looked at sedimentary layers and figured out that, in fact, you know, the Earth is not 4,000 years old, but more like 4.5 billion years old. And then there was, you know, quantum mechanics showing us that reality is too weird for us to understand, and Darwin showing us that we're actually cousins with all the other animals around us. There were a number of scientific dethronements in a row, and the suggestion in the last chapter of the book is that what's happening with the brain is this fall from the center of ourselves. We're finding that we're not really the ones driving the boat in our mental lives. But what I argue is that there's really an upside to dethronement. I mean, when we thought the Earth was at the center of everything, that was pretty neat. But we now have such a more wondrous and subtle picture of the cosmos around us. And we know that there are hundreds of billions of suns just like ours, and each any one of them might have planets around it with life forms and extraterrestrial civilizations. And, you know, it's opened up something so much grander than we would have ever thought. And that's exactly what's happening in brain science. We're sailing into this inner cosmos and finding all kinds of alien life forms there and realizing that the whole thing is much more wondrous and subtle than we could have ever imagined.
And is that a possibilianism?
That's right. Possibilism is closely related to that, which is that, you know, it's just essentially an appreciation of the vastness of the mystery that we find ourselves surrounded with. So I've sort of accidentally started this new movement called Possibilism, which merely says, you know, instead of subscribing to any sort of particular dogma, just go out there with an open mind to study the mystery and wonder that surrounds us.
Your previous book, Some, I was reading, is going to be made into an opera that's going to have its debut next year in London. Is that right?
That's right. That's right. The composer Max Richter is doing the music for it, and it'll be a full-fledged opera.
And are you in any way involved in its creation?
No, I was asked to write the libretto and I declined to because I want to see, you know, the beauty about writing a piece of fiction is that you write it and you sort of send it out in the world like a train that you build, and then other people add stuff to it and paint it and make things happen. And so I'm curious to see what he'll do with it next.
And do you sing?
I don't.
Okay. Well, it's been great fun, David Eagleman. Thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you, Marty.
You're very welcome. David Eagleman's book is called Incognito, The Secret Lives of Brain. And yes, a previous book that he wrote, Some, is going to be an opera debuting next year in London. And he joined us from the studios of KUHF, that's in Houston, Texas. He's director of the Laboratory of Perception and Action, also the director of the Initiative on Neuroscience and Law at Baylor College of Medicine. And we've been talking about his new book called Incognito, The Secret Lives of the Brain. And of course, took us in many different directions as we talked about what's inside his book. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes and you can find out much more about this program. Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of the show, and it's produced by Susan Greenbaum, Patty Leswing, Dennis Devine, and Debbie Builder. I'm Marty Moscoane. Thank you so much for joining us.